If you ask your doctor about how to reduce your risk for heart disease, that is coronary heart disease and heart attacks that remain the number one killer of Americans, they will tell you that reducing saturated fat, eating whole grains, perhaps taking a baby aspirin, and reducing cholesterol with the statin cholesterol drugs are the keys. Is this true? Of course it's not. 88 million Americans take statin cholesterol drugs, for instance, and there has been no measurable reduction in heart disease events. Many people have worked to reduce saturated fat intake, and it's part of the reason why we have record-setting levels of overweight and obesity now. In other words, the conventional ideas of reducing risk for heart disease are nothing more than fairy tales, based on misinterpretations, misrepresentations, and a desire to maintain the very profitable status quo of procedures for heart disease, the number one moneymaker for hospitals. Of course, the real tragedy is that the focus on cholesterol, saturated fat, etc., takes everyone's attention off the real causes of heart disease that are, in truth, identifiable, measurable, and readily correctable. Just don't ask your doctor to tell you how. So in this episode of Defiant Health, let's consider this question and discuss seven measures of heart disease risk that you are able to address on your own. Later in the podcast, let's talk about Defiant Health's sponsors that include Paleo Valley, who provides fermented grass-fed beef sticks, bone broth protein rich in collagen, organic super greens, and low-carb superfood bars, and now 100% grass-fed and finished pastured meats. And our newest sponsor, BiotaQuest, who provides unique probiotics, such as Sugar Shift to support healthy blood sugars, and Simple Slumber to assist in obtaining healthy sleep, probiotics crafted with the unique property of combining synergistic microbes. So if you've been advised to reduce your saturated fat, cholesterol, take a statin cholesterol drug, take a baby aspirin, exercise more, you need to know that you've done almost nothing to address risk for heart disease. Heart disease is everywhere. It's the number one killer of Americans. It's more common than cancers, dementia, and other health conditions. As I mentioned in the opening comments, it's also the number one moneymaker for hospitals. That is heart procedures like angioplasty, heart catheterization, bypass surgery, and related procedures. This all began with misinterpretations of very bad clinical studies performed in the 1950s and 1960s that led to this idea that cholesterol is the cause of heart disease. Let's be clear. Cholesterol is not the cause of heart disease. At best, it is a crude, indirect marker for the lipoproteins, the particles in the bloodstream that actually do cause heart disease. But it's been misconstrued as the actual cause for heart disease, and it is not. Cholesterol is a passenger on proteins that are able to transport fats through the blood. So we call them lipoproteins, fat-carrying proteins, because cholesterol is a fat, and fats cannot flow freely in the bloodstream, because if they did, they would coalesce and form globules that blocked flow in arteries. And so cholesterol does not do that. It instead is a passenger on a protein as a combined lipoprotein particle. And it's the character of these lipoproteins, their size, their number, their surface charge, their surface recognition proteins, and various other aspects that determine their behavior, that is, to determine whether or not they're going to contribute to causing atherosclerotic plaque in arteries such as the heart's arteries, the coronary arteries, or other arteries like the carotid arteries or the iliac or femoral arteries to the legs. The real tragedy, though, in my mind, is not that everyone's being misguided and thinking about cholesterol and statin drugs. It's that it took everybody's attention away from all the real causes of heart disease, for which you hear almost no conversations at all from doctors, from the healthcare system, from TV ads for drugs. There's no mention of the real causes of heart disease beyond this silly notion of cholesterol. You know, I did not appreciate all this until about 30 years ago when I opened someplace called Milwaukee Heart Scan. I did that because my mom, who underwent a successful two-vessel coronary angioplasty in New Jersey, where I grew up. And she went home and about 2 months later was found dead of sudden cardiac death. And so it drove home to me that the procedures that I was doing similar procedures in my hospitals in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. These procedures are a very poor fix for a very dangerous disease. And there are people like my mom who never make it to the hospital in order to have their arteries opened. And so I went looking for a way to identify people who are at risk for heart attacks, sudden cardiac death, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years before such catastrophes strike. This was true 30 years ago. It remains true today. The only real way to measure this disease, coronary atherosclerosis, that is the plaque that builds up in your arteries, the only way to truly measure it precisely, quantitatively, is to generate what's called a coronary calcium score using a CT heart scan. It's a CT device, and you can see calcium in the coronary arteries quite easily, and you can measure its volume very easily. Now, why do we measure calcium? Because calcium has been found to occupy 20% of total atherosclerotic plaque volume. This was proven by my friend, Dr. John Rumberger, when he was at Mayo Clinic, and he showed that calcium can be precisely measured and gives us a dipstick or gauge for total atherosclerotic plaque. So if you have 2 cubic millimeters of calcium, you have 10 cubic millimeters of total atherosclerotic plaque volume. So it's not a measure of blockage. That's a different kind of measure. It's a measure of the volume of plaque in the coronary arteries. Kind of think of it this way. If I had a foot-long piece of iron pipe, a blockage measurement would tell me something like this. 3 inches down from the left side of that pipe, there's a bunch of an accumulation of rust that can block water flow. That's a blockage type perspective. The CT heart scan or coronary calcium score is instead something like this. In this 1 foot of pipe, there's 253.4 cubic millimeters of rust. Two different kinds of measures. Now people say, oh, I want to know if I have blockage, but that's not what causes heart attacks. Heart attacks are caused by the rupture of a plaque that's not blocking flow. Maybe it's only 30% reduction in diameter of the artery. And that plaque is active. It's got inflammatory cells in it. It's got red blood cells. And it can rupture like a little volcano. When it ruptures and its internal contents are exposed to blood that's flowing past, this is a potent trigger for blood clotting. So it takes only a relatively minor plaque that's active and erupts and then triggers blood clot formation. That is what a heart attack is. So the best predictor is not percent blockage at one point in an artery. It's how much volume of atherosclerotic plaque you have, because the greater the volume, the more potential there is for plaque rupture or heart attack. Well, because of my interest in preventing heart disease events, I set up Milwaukee Heart Scan, and we scanned people left and right, thousands and thousands of people. One of the first scanners in the Midwest, one of just a handful that were available in the region. But we scanned thousands of people, and when you start looking for hidden heart disease in people who are going to work, going to school, jogging, riding their bikes, active with no symptoms, you find it everywhere. Now, we score it. A normal score, calcium score, is 0, and increasing scores signify increasing potential for heart disease events like heart attack because you have a greater volume of atherosclerotic plaque. So if you get to a score of 1,000, for instance, the risk for heart attack and sudden cardiac death is about 10 to 15% per year. So very high risk. And you can imagine over about 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you're virtually guaranteed to have a major cardiac event. So what do we do about it? Well, this goes back over 25 years ago. Back then, I would put people on the standard regimen. That is a low-fat diet, put them on a high dose of a statin cholesterol drug to reduce LDL cholesterol, a baby aspirin, sometimes other drugs like beta blockers, an exercise program. Now, it's important to know, we help publish these data, if you do nothing for your coronary calcium score, which is unwise, of course, right? But let's say your score is 300 and you do nothing. What will the score be 1 year later? It will be 25% higher. So it'll be 375. And then another year later, another 25% higher. And so with each leap, you're closer and closer to heart attack and death. What if you go on the best there is in conventional medicine, conventional cardiology? A baby aspirin, a low-fat, low-saturated fat diet, a high dose of a statin cholesterol drug, an exercise program, maybe some other drugs too. How fast will that score go up? 25% per year. That has been corroborated many times. It has virtually no impact on the growth of atherosclerotic plaque. Yet it's the only thing that you're given to reduce heart attack risk. Well, at a practical level, I had thousands of people essentially freaking out on me because they saw their scores going up, 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 getting closer to danger. Unfortunately, my colleagues would often say things like, well, let's do the real test, a heart catheterization to see if you need a stent, angioplasty, or bypass surgery. Now recall, these are not people in the emergency room with chest pain and can't breathe. These are people like you and me, going to school, going to work, exercising, climbing stairs, having no symptoms at all. So what they were doing, what my colleagues often do, is advocate a prophylactic or preventive procedure. And that, by the way, has been disproven. It has no benefit whatsoever, because regardless of where you put the stent or where you put the bypass, you cannot predict where plaque will rupture. Because if you're going to be going by the worst blockage, that's not where the rupture occurs. The rupture can occur in a 10% blockage, a 20%, 30% blockage. And you can't stent the entire three coronary arteries, of course, right? You can't bypass everything either. So you can't predict where an event's going to occur, where a plaque rupture is going to occur. So it's clear in a number of studies that doing prophylactic procedures is of no benefit. Yet it's done all the time. And people are scared when they're told that heart attack or other major cardiac event is imminent. So they often resort to such ridiculous procedures for indications that are not real. And of course, the hospital, the doctor, makes a lot of money doing unnecessary procedures. Sad to say, this is very common. So what do we do? This is over 20 years ago. Well, I stumbled about trying to find better solutions. There are no experts in this. The purported experts said things like this. Well, if you can't stop the increase in the coronary calcium score, just don't repeat the scan. Let them have their heart attacks and other events and then deal with it. They actually said that. A number of so-called experts actually said that. Well, I refused to accept that. So I set about trying to identify factors that would put a stop to this 25% per year relentless increase in coronary calcium scores. And there was a lot of trial and error and use of logic and resorting to the science. But it led to lessons like this. When you add vitamin D, the way we do it, the way I do it, which is to add an oil-based gel cap form of vitamin D3 or cholecalciferol at a dose sufficient to raise your 25-hydroxy vitamin D blood level to 60 to 70 nanograms per milliliter. Typical dose would be 6,000 units for an average size man, 4 to 5,000 units for an average size woman. And it was the first time I saw coronary calcium scores plummet. Score of, say, 700 would come back as 420 or something like that. At first, I didn't believe it. And I went back to the original scan of somebody and then the follow-up scan. And yes, indeed, the coronary calcium, you can see quite easily, has shrunk dramatically. Even though these heart scans are made to visualize calcium, you can also see the softer elements to some degree. And you could actually see that the other components of the atherosclerotic plaque has shrunk. Now, before I added vitamin D, I had used fish oil and used some other efforts to try to stop. And I did manage to slow it down from 25% to maybe 12 to 18%, but still growing quite rapidly. When I added vitamin D, it was the first time I saw scores drop. Not in everybody, but in the majority. So having a coronary calcium score generated by a CT heart scan gives you something to track. It tells you whether or not you're having success in your heart disease prevention program. Cholesterol does not tell you this. And that's why, once you build this house of cards on this false premise that cholesterol causes heart disease, it leads you to useless methods of dealing with it, such as statin cholesterol drugs to reduce cholesterol. So if you do nothing, coronary calcium score goes up 25% per year. If you take a statin cholesterol drug and all the other things they do in conventional care, still goes up 25% per year. There are other tests, other lessons we can use. So let's discard this idea that cholesterol is the cause for heart disease and that cholesterol tells you what your risk is. It does not. It is an extremely poor predictor. But there's a superior predictor when it comes to lipoproteins. So rather than indirectly gauge what your lipoproteins are doing by using cholesterol values, let's actually measure the lipoproteins. Now, there are a number of ways to do this, but the method that has emerged as the most available, gold standard, and expensive also, is NMR lipoprotein analysis, nuclear magnetic resonance lipoprotein analysis. It's the MRI device. It's also called an MRI. Just like the kind you get to scan your chest or your pelvis or your abdomen, you can put plasma, the clear part of your blood, into an MRI device or NMR device, and you can actually count the number of various lipoproteins in your bloodstream. It's available. It's been around for over 30 years. It's inexpensive. But don't be surprised if you ask your doctor and say, hey, I'd like to get an NMR lipoprotein test in place of my cholesterol. He or she is likely to say, oh, it's unproven, it's experimental, or insurance won't pay for it. None of that is true. It's been around for decades, and it typically costs about $100, so a little more than a cholesterol test, but it gives you the real information. But there's two pieces of information you really need off your NMR lipoprotein analysis, and that is the number of small LDL particles and how much VLDL. And you can make this even easier. So while I bash cholesterol testing, the triglyceride value on your cholesterol testing is a helpful measure because triglycerides perfectly parallel VLDL. And so we know that any triglyceride value greater than 60 milligrams per deciliter is accompanied by both an increase in VLDL that directly causes coronary atherosclerosis and VLDL, a particle that's very low density, VLDL, is rich in fat, triglycerides. And when you have a lot of VLDL particles, as signified by a higher triglyceride level over 60, VLDL particles interact with LDL particles, not LDL cholesterol, LDL particles. And the VLDL particles, rich in triglycerides, make the LDL particle also rich in triglycerides. That leads to a subsequent series of events, of reactions, that leads to formation of small LDL particles. So you want to know how much small LDL particles you have, and you want to have your triglyceride level of 60 milligrams per deciliter or less, so that you don't have VLDL available. Now, small LDL is important because small LDL particles persist for an unusually long time in your bloodstream. So large LDL particles provoked by consumption of fats and oils only stick around the bloodstream for about 24 hours because the liver recognizes it readily and clears it from your bloodstream. But if you eat something, a food that triggers formation of small LDL particles, the small LDL particles have a different surface shape and the liver has a hard time recognizing it. And that means small LDL particles circulate in the bloodstream around and around for 5 to 7 days, giving it lots of opportunity to enter the wall of the arteries, such as the coronary arteries. Small LDL particles stick around for a lot longer than large LDL particles. By the way, what foods cause formation of small LDL particles and VLDL? The amylopectin A of wheat and grains and sugars, period. Not bacon, not fat, not saturated fat, not pork. Only wheat, grains, and sugars. Small LDL is dangerous also because it's very adherent to the arterial wall. When it enters the arterial wall, it's much more likely to provoke an inflammatory response. So small LDL particles triggered by consumption of wheat, grains, and sugars is a very potent cause for heart disease. And it has nothing to do with LDL cholesterol, the indirect way to try to guesstimate lipoproteins. We're measuring lipoproteins directly. So we try to get those small LDL particles below 200 nanomoles per liter. It's a particle count per volume measure. A typical starting number would be 1,800, 2,400. Oodles of small LDL particles. So we go wheat, grains, and sugar-free in our diets, and you have dramatic reductions, typically to zero, or certainly below 200 nanomoles per liter. So if you have a positive coronary calcium score, now you're armed with the information from your NMR lipoproteins, you now know what diet causes coronary disease. And by the way, the first time you have your NMR lipoprotein analysis, request, you have to specifically request this, a lipoprotein A. It's a genetic pattern that heightens the risk for coronary disease. That's a whole nother conversation of its own, but people with lipoprotein, there's some additional steps we take to control that source of risk. As I mentioned earlier, knowing what your vitamin D status is critical. So we aim for a 25 hydroxy vitamin D blood level, very easy to do, of 60 to 70 nanograms per milliliter. Most people start out in the teens, like 14 or 15, especially if you live in a northern climate. And then we supplement vitamin D at a dose sufficient to raise the 25-hydroxyvitamin D blood level to 60 to 70, the level that I believe is the ideal, and we've never seen a single instance of toxicity at that level in thousands of people. And of course, beyond reduction in coronary calcium scores and reduction of cardiovascular risk, many other benefits to taking vitamin D. Another important set of measures are the measures that are relevant to your thyroid status. Thyroid dysfunction is very common. We start by supplementing iodine. Iodine, people have forgotten, was a worldwide public health problem for as long as humans have been on this planet. People who lack iodine intake can develop hypothyroidism and then more severe levels of hypothyroidism called myxedema, and you can go into heart failure and die. Many people have died of iodine deficiency over the years. They might die of the goiter, the enlarged thyroid gland that compresses the airway or infiltrates the great vessels, or they die of the hypothyroidism. They gain 50, 60, 70 pounds, they can't function, they sleep 14 hours a day, and then they eventually die of heart failure. So iodine deficiency was a major problem until 1924, when the FDA finally recognized that it was due to lack of iodine, that goiters and hypothyroidism, many cases, are due to lack of iodine. So they added iodine to salt, iodized salt, and advised people to consume a lot of salt. People listened, and goiters essentially went away for many years. But then the FDA misinterpreted what happened when people used a lot of salt. They thought it was causing hypertension and other problems with sodium. What they didn't recognize was that their diet, to cut saturated fat, cut fat, eat more grains, causes sodium retention because it causes insulin resistance. That is a sodium retaining phenomenon. So rather than blaming their misleading dietary advice, they misinterpreted as overuse of salt and told everybody to cut back on their salt. So guess what's coming back? Iodine deficiency and goiters. So replacing iodine, very easy. You could use iodized salt, but you have to know that once you open the canister of iodized salt, the iodine is volatile and is gone within 3 to 4 weeks. So a better way to do this is to buy simple, inexpensive kelp tablets, dried seaweed tablets, or potassium iodide drops that you can add to any drink, beverage, or other food. And we try to get around 300 to 400, somewhere in that range, micrograms per day, more than the RDA, because I believe the ideal intake of iodine is higher than the 150 microgram per day intake that's set by the RDA. Some people will have to have further efforts to identify thyroid dysfunction. That's always worth looking at. And a full thyroid panel would include a TSH, a thyroid stimulating hormone, it's a pituitary hormone, a free T3, a free T4, the two important thyroid hormones, a reverse T3, and thyroid antibodies. With those measures, you'll have a full handle on what's going on in your thyroid. Now, just bear in mind, this is a conversation for another day, but if you do have hypothyroidism, most commonly identified as a high or high-ish TSH, so an ideal TSH is 2.0 microunits or less. Let's say you come back with a 4.2. Well, you have mild hypothyroidism sufficient to add hugely to the growth in your coronary atherosclerotic plaque. So if iodine doesn't correct it, now it's time to turn to thyroid hormone replacement, because there's lots and lots of thyroid dysfunction in this world. Probably due to a number of things. One reason may be the consumption of the gliadin protein of wheat, which triggers autoimmune attacks on your thyroid, such as Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Or it could be due to exposure to halogenated industrial compounds, like perfluorooctanoic acid and other so-called forever chemicals, or PFAS, P-F-A-S, that also have the capacity to disrupt thyroid physiology. And if you do have hypothyroidism, I urge you to talk to a doctor who is willing to prescribe a combination tablet that contains both the T3 and the T4 thyroid hormones, because the majority of people do better on it. A typical story is this. Someone says, I had hypothyroidism. My doctor put me on levothyroxine or Synthroid, which is the T4 thyroid hormone alone, but not the T3. Well, one of the problems is that those chemicals block the conversion of T4 to the T3, the truly active thyroid hormone, T3. So you're taking lots of T4, but you're also being exposed, as all of us are, to a compound that blocks conversion to the active T3. And people say things like this: I take my levothyroxine, but I'm gaining weight, I have leg edema, I'm tired all the time, my hair is falling out, I'm depressed. It's because they are not getting enough T3. So a better solution than taking just T4 is to take a combination tablet that contains both T3 and T4. These go by names such as Armour Thyroid, Nature Thyroid, ERFA, E-R-F-A, and some other brands. The problem is to persuade the doctor that people do better on T3 and T4, not just T4. You may have to consult with a functional medicine practitioner or some other better informed doctor than your general practitioner or endocrinologist. Now let's just pause for a bit and talk about the sponsors of my Defiant Health podcast. When we come back, we'll resume the conversation, talk about several other important measures you can obtain that put you in the driver's seat for reducing cardiovascular risk. The Defiant Health podcast is sponsored by Paleo Valley. makers of delicious grass-fed beef sticks, healthy snack bars, and other products. We are very picky around here and insist that any product we consider has no junk ingredients like carrageenan, carboxymethyl cellulose, sucralose, and of course no added sugars. And all Paleo Valley products contain no gluten nor grains. In fact, I find Paleo Valley products among cleanest in their category. One of the habits I urge everyone to get into is to include at least one, if not several, servings of fermented foods per day in their lifestyles. Unlike nearly all other beef sticks available, Paleo Valley grass-fed beef sticks are all naturally fermented, meaning they contain probiotic bacterial species. And now Paleo Valley is expanding their Wild Pastures program that provides 100% grass-fed, grass-finished, pastured beef and pastured chicken and pork, raised without herbicides or pesticides. And they just added wild-caught seafood, caught from the waters of Bristol Bay, Alaska. Among their other new products are pasture-raised, fermented pork sticks, chocolate-flavored grass-fed bone broth protein, and grass-fed organ complex in capsule form, and new essential electrolytes in powder form to add to potassium and magnesium intake, available in orange, lemon, and melon flavors. Listeners to the Defiant Health Podcast receive a 15% discount by going to paleovalley.com/defiant health. And I'd like to welcome Defiant Health's newest sponsor, BiotaQuest. I've had numerous conversations with BiotaQuest founders, Martha Carlin and academic microbiologist, Dr. Raul Cano. They have formulated unique synergistic probiotic products that incorporate what are called collaborative or guild effects. That is, groups of microbes that collaborate with each other via specific metabolites, potentially providing synergistic benefits. They have designed their Sugar Shift probiotic to support healthy blood sugars, Simple Slumber to support sleep, Ideal Immunity to support a healthy immune response, Heart Centered that supports several aspects of heart health, and Antibiotic Antidote designed to support recovery of the gastrointestinal microbiome after a course of antibiotics. The BiotaQuest probiotics are, I believe, among the most effective of all probiotic choices for specific health effects. Enter the discount code UNDOC15, UNDOC, all caps, 15, for a 15% discount for Defiant Health listeners. Another set of measures very important for you to understand and manage to reduce your cardiovascular risk are all the measures that surround insulin and glucose. And these are very simple. So blood draw for a fasting insulin, a fasting glucose, and a hemoglobin A1C that shows you long-term behavior of glucose. And we aim for a fasting glucose of between 70 and 90 milligrams per deciliter. We aim for a fasting insulin as close to zero as possible, no higher than 4 microunits per liter. Commonly in people who are insulin resistant, which is very common, levels of 30, 70, 100, 130 are very common. In other words, as much as 100-fold higher than ideal. And then lastly, hemoglobin A1C that reflects 90 days, your previous 90 days of blood sugars, we aim for a level of 5.0% or less. Many times you have to ignore the advice of my colleagues, of doctors. They say things like hemoglobin A1C of up to 6.5 is okay. Is that true? No. That's when you become diabetic. That's a hemoglobin A1C of 6.5% or greater signifies type 2 diabetes. What they're saying to you is you don't need insulin or a collection of diabetes drugs yet, so you must therefore be okay. The lack of drug, need for drug, in their mind, is means you're okay, which is not true. For instance, for a hemoglobin A1C of 5.7, which is the cutoff for prediabetes, there's a 300% increase in cardiovascular risk. How is that normal? It's not normal. So at what level does all the excess risk provided by hemoglobin A1C disappear? 5.0% and less. So we want all three of those measures, fasting glucose, fasting insulin, and hemoglobin A1C, all in perfect range. How do you achieve perfection? By the program that I advocate. That is the diet program, replacing the nutrients lacking in modern life, magnesium, vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids, iodine, and then addressing the microbiome, which we'll get to in just a moment. Getting some measure of inflammation helps you also gauge whether your program is working or not. The most common one is a high sensitivity C-reactive protein. There are many others like IL-6, IL-beta-1-beta, 200 necrosis factor alpha, but you don't really need those if you just get a basic C-reactive protein. And we try to get that value as close to zero as possible because inflammation is an amplifier of a lot of the abnormal patterns that lead to heart disease. And then lastly, we address the disrupted bowel flora you have, either dysbiosis confined to the colon, or very commonly, if you have coronary disease by some measure, let's say a positive calcium score, coronary calcium score, it's highly likely that you have SIBO, that is, fecal microbes from the colon have been allowed to proliferate and then ascend into the 24 feet of small intestine. And now you have trillions of microbes that live for only a few hours. They don't live very long. Turning over rapidly, trillions of microbes living and dying rapidly. When they die, they are breakdown products, especially something called LPS, or lipopolysaccharide endotoxin, is able to penetrate the intestinal wall. Because a small intestine, where microbes, fecal microbes are not supposed to be, small intestine is by design very permeable, because that's where you absorb nutrients, vitamins, minerals, fatty acids, amino acids, and other things. So the small intestine is meant to be permeable. But when you have fecal microbes that have invaded the small intestine, trillions of them, rapid turnover, you have a flood of endotoxin from the breakdown products of these microbes into the bloodstream, first to the liver, then to the systemic circulation, and these amplify all the other abnormalities. It amplifies VLDL particles. It amplifies production of small LDL particles. It worsens inflammation. It inflames the walls of the coronary arteries and other arteries. It raises blood sugar. It raises triglycerides. It raises blood pressure. It has emotional effects like anger, frustration, and depression, and anxiety. So we identify SIBO in a number of ways. One way would be to look for what I call our telltale signs. So if you see fat droplets in the toilet during a bowel movement, that's a sign, because that means microbes, fecal microbes, have reached the duodenum. That's where the bile is emptied from the gallbladder, and that's where pancreatic enzymes are secreted into the duodenum. So if you have failure to absorb fats, that shows you that there are microbes interfering with fat digestion in the duodenum. If you have a food intolerance, whether it's to FODMAPs or fruit or nightshades or histamine-containing foods or any other form of food intolerance, think SIBO, because SIBO causes food intolerances. And the vast majority of food intolerances go away when you correct the SIBO. There are also conditions that are virtually synonymous with SIBO. That is, the occurrence of SIBO is so high that if you have any of these conditions, you can safely assume that you have SIBO. Fibromyalgia, very high, perhaps as high as 100% of people with fibromyalgia have SIBO. Chronic fatigue syndrome, irritable bowel syndrome, any autoimmune or neurodegenerative disorder, restless leg syndrome. These are all very highly associated with SIBO, such that you can pretty much assume you have SIBO even without confirmatory testing. Fatty liver is another one. Obesity, very high association with SIBO. Now, if you want to confirm testing, the most common test is hydrogen breath testing that you can do in a lab or clinic. Unfortunately, it means having a doctor who understands SIBO and has kept up with the science. Most practicing physicians have not. So you may have to find somebody who can do that for you. Or you can buy the consumer device called the AIRE device, A-I-R-E, made by a company in Ireland named Food Marble. You can measure hydrogen gas on the breath. The exact way to do it is in my Super Gut book. There's a process you follow. There's a prep, and then you do testing, and you supplement something like inulin in your coffee or other food, and then you test and see how soon hydrogen gas is released. Because the sooner it's released after consuming the inulin, the higher up microbes are living in the GI tract. So please consult my Super Gut book or my drdavisinfinitehealth.com blog. I tell you how to use the device. Now, should you suspect that you have SIBO or you confirm that it is present with positive H2 breath testing, hydrogen breath testing, how do you get rid of it? Well, you could go to a conventional doctor if the doctor even knew what it was, that is SIBO and positive hydrogen breath. They would at best prescribe the antibiotic Xifaxan or rifaximin. Well, you know, I'm reluctant to advocate that because antibiotics, overexposure to antibiotics, is a big part of the reason we have this problem, that is SIBO. So how about we try something different? This is the sequence of logic I followed. What if you took just an off-the-shelf commercial probiotic for your SIBO? Will your SIBO go away? Will you push down fecal microbes back to where they belong in the colon? No. You might reduce bloating a little bit or diarrhea, but you'll still be left with this problem, the SIBO. So what if we asked different questions? What if we chose microbes, probiotic microbes, that we know will colonize the small intestine? That's where the battle is, right? Not the colon, but the small intestine. And what if we chose species and strains of microbes that are known to produce what are called bacteriocins? These are natural antibiotics effective against the species of SIBO. So I chose three initially. I chose a strain of Lactobacillus gasseri and a strain of Lactobacillus reuteri. Both colonize the upper GI tract and produce up to a total of 11 bacteriocins. I also threw in Bacillus coagulans because it has a good track record in reducing bloating and symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. I'm less confident how necessary the Bacillus coagulans is, but I will tell you that adding Bacillus coagulans makes the yogurt much tastier. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to ferment these creatures as yogurt. It doesn't have to be dairy, by the way, but dairy is the easiest to use. And we co-ferment those three, or at least the gasseri and the reuteri. And so far, we've had 90% success in normalizing breath hydrogen testing and witnessing the reversal of numerous SIBO-associated phenomena. We see reversal of food intolerances, reversal of fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, and other conditions. And along with correction of your SIBO and endotoxemia and hydrogen gas breath testing, or reversal of the associated conditions, you're going to see all sorts of other positive effects that have benefits in cardiovascular health. You're going to see a reduction in blood pressure, a reduction in the inflammatory measures like C-reactive protein, a reduction in triglycerides and VLDL, a reduction in small LDL particles. In other words, you've seen across-the-board improvement by reducing this flood of endotoxemia that accompanies SIBO. So there you have it. Those are the seven tools or measures you can use to gain full control over cardiovascular risk from coronary disease and related events. We're going to get a coronary calcium score. We're going to get NMR lipoproteins to gauge the small LDL particles as well as VLDL. Be sure to have a lipoprotein A run the first time you have it. You don't have to repeat that lipoprotein A because it doesn't change. It's genetically programmed. There's no need to reduce it, by the way. We just add some additional steps to manage lipoprotein A. Get your vitamin D. Get your thyroid assessed and start iodine. Get your glucose, insulin, hemoglobin A1C assessed to see what your blood sugar and insulin status is. Get a measure of inflammation such as C-reactive protein. And then consider dysbiosis, but even more so, SIBO and endotoxemia. You now have a means of eradicating it by making a yogurt. And by the way, the recipe for the yogurt that I call SIBO yogurt is in my Super Gut book. It's also in my drdavisinfinitehealth.com blog. If this is all confusing to you, I urge you to, once again, get my Super Gut book, as well as the Wheat Belly books if you want a more deep dive into the diet. You can always join our conversations. We have extensive conversations, including face-to-face talks via Zoom, on my drdavisinfinitehealth.com inner circle. So for instance, most Wednesdays we meet for about 2 hours. Typically 90 people show up and we talk about how to make SIBO yogurt. What do you do when you don't achieve your 60 to 70 nanograms per milliliter vitamin D blood level? How to interpret thyroid panels? We do all this in our inner circle. You can post your information or your questions in the forum, which is extremely busy, hundreds of thousands of posts. There's lots of learning materials, many, many videos, our two-way interaction, and lots of other learning materials and resources. The goal here being equipping you with information and tools because the doctor's not doing their jobs. So if you learned something from this episode of Defiant Health Podcast, I invite you to subscribe via your favorite podcast directory, post a review, post a comment, and join the conversation, the movement to empower you in health and keep you as free of the healthcare system as possible. Thanks for listening.